Welcome to the New York Times podcast, your pleasant melody of music news and cultural emissions. I'm your host, Ben Ratliff.
Before I lose sight of that picture of you, better place it face down on the bed. Notice how nature.
And today's guest is Ardo Lindsay. Hey, Ardo.
Hey, man.
Welcome. I and many other people saw you last night at Le Poisson Rouge with a new band. This is a new band.
It's a new band.
And you've done some touring in Europe. Last night's gig was kind of the first big showing of the new band in New York, no?
True.
I mean, we can get into this, like, do you view your life in periods thing later. But it feels to me like Ardo's back. Am I wrong about that?
Well,
and it could be the fourth or fifth chapter.
I'm definitely planning to do a lot of playing with the band.
Yeah.
You know, I want to get back out there with the band. For the last few years, I've been doing a lot of solos. I kind of wanted to figure out how to do a solo and make it work. And I've been doing things in, I don't know, I guess the art world. I've been organizing a lot of parades.
It's funny, word filters back very slowly from what you've been up to in Brazil. Every once in a while, I've sort of looked around and said, you know, what is Ardo doing now? And I get something about a parade. In fact, one was in New York.
Yeah.
Right? At least one. I don't know.
Right over here, Times Square.
Okay. So tell us about these parade pieces.
Well, that's a nice way to put it. Parade pieces, they're an extension of, you know, my involvement with carnival in Brazil, especially in Bahia.
Yeah.
Went to carnival every year for about 10 or 15 years, and I performed, and I helped organize, and I produced records for carnival groups. And
yeah.
I did a parade down there with Matthew Barney.
Yeah.
We had wanted to collaborate. We ended up doing a parade there. And due to that, I started to get requests to do parades myself in other places. So they're a kind of personal carnival or something, you know.
What are you into?
Some of them involve a lot of collaborators. They all involve a lot of participants. Some of them involve collaborators, too.
Well, if you had to break it down, this thing about parades and music in parades, what's the appeal to you? I mean, this, like, procession, musicians walking through a public space.
Right.
Many musicians making a loose, massed sound. What is it?
A parade itself is like, can carry so much meaning, you know, and I like the idea of something that's so easy to enjoy, but can carry so many types of information, you know, so it can be like in some of the parades have philosophers philosophizing and they're mic'd and they're thrown into the mix along with musicians. Sometimes different parts of the parade trigger other parts in the sound system.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I had some gypsies in a parade in Berlin, and I had a Brazilian percussionist, and the gypsies were all mic'd, and their mics only came on when the percussionist hit the drums. So if you're down the street,
really,
you just hear them in bursts, in samba heggy bursts.
Wow.
It's just a way to get a lot of ideas out there all together, you know what I mean?
Right.
And you know, parades are great because they go and go and go, and you kind of go somewhere, not just physically, but mentally or whatever. You go to another place.
Plus, everybody loves them because
everybody
they're inclusive.
Them. They're
so
really inclusive.
You get away with murder.
You remember Carnival in Bahia, too,
sure.
the energy, and it's just, as far as I'm concerned, the most amazing visual spectacle I've ever seen, you know. Huge crowds of people, and everything is going on. People are like, you know, crying, you know, going into ecstasy, you know what I'm saying, being bored, you know, buying, selling, thieving. It's all going on, you know.
Yeah. Visual, but physical is the right word.
Right.
Those experiences I had in Bahia, I mean, I remember certain moments of being in huge crowds and there being a kind of flowing feeling, like it wasn't hectic and crazy.
Exactly.
It was something entirely
so much
positive.
Safer than you imagined
it
being, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah. Back to the beginning, because I think a lot of people are probably listening to this thinking, who is this guy? All right, so there's a new record But part of the reason we're having you here and you played last night and everything is there's a new record called Encyclopedia of Arto. And the first disc, it's reminding us about what you did in the 90s and half of the aughts, right?
Yeah.
And then the second disc is live solo voice and guitar from recent years.
Right.
The idea to do a kind of self-anthology for you focused on that string of records from mid-90s to 2000 whatever. Why not before? You know, why not other things? What is it about that string of records?
Well, I think they're of a piece.
Yeah.
Eventually it'd be nice to anthologize everything, you know what I mean? But I thought this was a way to suggest everything without having to include everything.
Right.
And then, of course, there are the practical issues of rights.
Sure.
Which are...
tricky.
Tricky.
So by everything, we mean you played in the band DNA starting in 1978.
Right.
For a couple of years.
Yep.
Right?
Three years, yeah.
And then Ambitious Lovers starting 84. Yeah.
And in between, you know, in between I started Lounge Lizards, well,
right,
with a group of guys and
sure,
eventually left, and Golden Palominos.
Right.
And did a lot of playing with Kip Hanrahan.
So DNA was a no-wave band, and it was clearly set up, it seems to me. I wasn't there, you know, so I only know the records. It seems to me that it was clearly set up as kind of an experiment.
Not really, you know. I mean, I've said this a gazillion times.
Say it again.
But basically, growing up, the most experimental, edgiest, most forward-looking, new-seeking, or whatever, yeah, music was also extremely popular, you know. I grew up listening to Jimi Hendrix.
Yeah.
Do you know what I'm saying? I grew up listening to Miles Davis and Georges Bain and Caetano Veloso, and these guys were trying to do something new.
Yeah.
And they were also really popular, and people liked the fact that they were trying to do something new. So, naively, we in DNA and a bunch of us thought that, you know, if we came up with something really original, people would love it.
Sure.
For some reason, we were judged. We were seen as anti-musical. It was seen as a negative thing. And, you know, by this August journal, mm-hmm, in specific, you know what I'm saying? Specifically, we were like kind of put down as being deliberately negative and stuff, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's much easier for people to understand noise as being ecstatic as well as being aggressive, you know. But at that point, nobody made that connection, you know what I mean?
Right. Noise as being sensual.
Extremely sensual music, you
but
know?
But in all those cases that you
but
mentioned.
But also ecstatic in a however you want to understand it, you know what I'm saying, as an expression of ecstasy, bliss, some
sure,
kind of spirituality.
Sure. In those cases that you mentioned, though, Hendrix, Miles Davis, there's some kind of underlying, you know,
funk.
Groove. There's some
yeah,
funk,
yeah,
right?
Right.
I don't know if you'll agree with this, but it might have been harder to locate in DNA.
I don't agree.
Okay.
We had people throwing chairs. Well, we had plenty of people making out.
Right.
They've stopped throwing chairs at me, but they're still making out. Last night at Poisson Rouge, we had a lot going on in the front there. I don't know where you were standing, but so yeah, I think that I kind of always assumed or accepted that this is what music was about.
Yeah.
No matter what else it was also about, it was about sex.
Okay, so we came in on The Prize, your song The Prize. That's from one of the, you know, full band records. But now let's hear a little bit of solo voice and guitar performance from Encyclopedia of Arto called Privacy.
Sitting by the window, looking out, dog. Could be. Import, resell. Two shiny things. Looking very snug. You ever get that giraffe? See that dog? Most cold mouth. Passing. Ah! Oh, shouldn't go on this computer. Two shiny things. Get his nug! looking at drag through that door. Privacy all around that privacy.
Ardo, has your relationship to the guitar changed much or at all?
And are we getting into some DR in Portuguese? Discussão de relação, discussing the relationship, something that every couple goes through. It's like I decided to let it grow unweeded. This was, It's kind of a clumsy word, but it's a word that I actually used.
I mean, you started playing guitar not long before the first DNA gig, right?
Correct.
There was some serious, youthful bravado in that kind of intuitive way that you played, which was, percussive and
noisy. Also, there's an element of parody in the way I play.
Yeah.
It's like I'm making all the gestures of a guitar player sometimes. I'm playing where the guitar player would play within the arrangement, you know what I mean? But I'm not making any harmonic decisions, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? Or if so, they're very, very broad, like high, mid, low, top of the neck, bottom of the neck kind of thing. But I think that it was always thought out. In DNA, we restricted our improvisations to really short bursts.
Right.
We repeated as much as we could. We practiced an awful lot, even though people thought we were an improvising band. You know, we were
not. Oh,
no. Not at all. Well, one thing I despise about the way many improvisers think, they think this that they can sort of continue to be spontaneous forever. You know what I'm saying? They mm-hmm. don't realize that these habits, they build up habits pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So in a sense, I've guided at a distance, my technique, mm-hmm. I kind of let it happen. I think I'm a much better guitar player than I was at the beginning because I have mm-hmm. a lot more, I've developed many more gestures, you know what I mean?
Sure.
And relationships to other things that are going on in the music.
Previous to last night, the time that I saw you most recently was at the Guggenheim.
Ooh.
You were up there on stage. It was just you and guitar, no band. And your amp wasn't working.
No, the pedals.
Ah.
The pedals did not work. So I was restricted to one sound.
Right. And it was an interesting situation. Much more interesting for me, maybe, than for,
Yeah.
I was just sitting in the chair.
It was tough.
But I was like, how are you going to get out of this, Batman? Anybody who's watched you play guitar understands that, there's a strong rhythmic thing in there. And it is not just, Ardo making up his own rhythms. It's samba-based, a lot of it. This was what came out, unamplified. Doing that, maybe sort of fused with your own body language and your singing and whatever, it was impressive because it came out as one coherent whole.
Right.
And it could have been a disaster.
Yeah. Believe me, I know. There's a lot you can do by implication. It's something that I guess I picked up from singers, but I heard Chet Baker when he could barely sing. And I heard Jimmy Scott many times, when it was tough for him to reach some notes, But
right.
You can almost point at a note, and have somebody hear it if you set it up right, So you can imply – listen to João Gilberto, you hear a samba school. You hear all that percussion.
Sure.
It's all there. And sure. He's not necessarily playing it. He's kind of playing around it or playing as if it was actually there,
Sure. There's a whole lot in his thumb,
yeah.
Maybe. Or,
yeah.
Or,
he does the different sudo and patterns down there.
Yeah. But working with limitations, all musicians do that. Even musicians who even Yngwie Malmsteen probably does it.
Thank you for choosing that example.
that's part of what musicians do is they figure out what they can do and what they can't do.
Right.
And they construct an original way to work with their set.
I have amazing models for learning how to do that, In João Gilberto, and Caetano
yeah.
also.
Yeah.
Guys that gradually got better and better.
Yeah.
And learned how to take, particular vocal tone that they had and do an awful lot with it,
In your music, there's often balance between abruptness, and swing. And sometimes I feel like the music is about how one fits into the other, or how one can rest on the other.
Yeah, I realize that's going on. And that goes also for extremes of you know, dynamic extremes.
Yeah.
And the contrast between the singing and the guitar sometimes, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Or even the just the different guitar tones, you know, you get from playing the guitar itself or from the pedals or whatever, you know.
With stuff like that, with tone, you know, do you feel like you leave a lot to chance?
Not so much with tone, no. Mm-hmm. But with harmony. But, you know, I figured out how to sing in tune over without a harmonic underpinning. Without,
right.
Without – the guitar is out of tune, but it's fairly stable.
Right.
You know? I mean, I play a Dan Electro, which is kind of – you know, it's not super stable. If I was backing up another singer on my guitar, they would hate me.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? But it's kind of sits where it is. My ear adjusts, and I can stay in key over the guitar.
Are you playing at Death by Audio on Monday?
I am. I'm playing with another guitar player, Ophir Gannon, and two drummers.
Greg Fox.
And Greg Saunier.
And Greg Saunier from Deerhoof.
Yeah.
If I go to that, will your guitar be tuned the same way that it was last night?
No. let's be frank.
Mm-hmm. I remember I asked you this once, you know, what's your system for tuning your guitar? And you said, pleasant melody?
Yeah, I usually make a little melody out of the strings.
So it's just, it's the relation of the pitches, open pitches to each other. It just sounds nice to you.
You know, I make a little melody up out of the strings. And it's also about, what's the right word? Not malleability, but, you know, how it feels to my hand. I mean, it's mm-hmm. the tension, mm-hmm. you know, the you know, guitar.
To your hand, but also probably to your ear, right? Because you can hear the lower tuned strings. You can hear that nasty sound.
Right. Sometimes. Well, usually I tune it before I go on stage, and then throughout the set I play with the tension of the low string. I play a 12 string, but I only use 11 strings, so that low string is by itself. It doesn't have a pair.
So for many of the records that you made in the 90s and zeros, anthologized on the first disc of Encyclopedia of Ardo, there was a core of you and Andres Levine and
Melvin Gibbs.
Gibbs.
To some extent, Vinicius Cantuaria.
Right.
And also Patrick Dillett, engineer,
mm-hmm.
does a lot of producing on his own now too, you know, very important.
And you wrote songs with these guys.
Yeah.
So let's say you were going to write material for a new studio record next week. How would you construct it?
Bring a few lines of lyrics. Start with some chords. Somebody's playing some chords. I'm trying to get a melody going over it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I can suggest chords by offering a leading note. Mm-hmm. The melody could go in this direction. Usually it's me and somebody who plays a guitar. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't play chords on the guitar myself, I don't remember melodies as easily as the guys that I'm writing with usually, you know, so that's something I have to work hard on, you know, because I think knowing harmony really helps you remember melodies.
Sure. I guess I can see that, yeah.
Believe me, it's
uh-huh,
true.
Uh-huh.
And, so we usually build it up like that, you know.
But when you write lyrics, you're not writing with a melody in mind?
I'm writing with a kind of melodic direction or something, you know what I mean? But it's not fixed necessarily. You know?
Right.
But actually, the more I do it, the more fleshed out the melody is sometimes, you know, when I write the words.
Well, so the new group is you, Melvin Gibbs again.
Always.
Paul Wilson, keyboard player.
Yep.
And Casa Overall, the drummer.
Yeah.
And how did, you know, Casa Overall... There's an interesting musician. I mean, I've seen him with Jerry Allen and Peter Evans, I think, trumpet player. Like he's in jazz world, right. But also does other things.
He also does rap records. He works with one of the guys from Das Racist. They have a thing. Yeah, it's funny. In a way, I just thought that, you know, in the 80s, I used to make a living playing improvised music and experimental music in Europe, especially in Germany, while I was trying to make a more, I don't know what to call it, more like these solo records, you know, kind of combining soul, samba, and whatever else, you know. In other words, make a more pop kind of record in America. But I was actually making my money playing
talking about Ambitious Lovers?
The hairier stuff. Yeah, the very beginning of the Ambitious Lovers, right. You know. In a way, Casa is like that now because he makes a living playing jazz, mostly, while he's trying to get his rap thing together.
While he's doing rap for free.
Yeah, but he's trying to – he doesn't always do it for free. You know?
Right, right.
I like those guys. They do a lot of beats.
So, okay, back up for a second. You're telling me that you were doing better doing whatever in Germany than you were here with Ambitious Lovers?
At the beginning, for sure, you know. I mean, things change, you know, as far as the way music is, you know, the economics of music. But in Germany in the 80s, there was so much government support, you know,
yeah.
And divided Germany. West Germany was just overflowing with money for the arts, you know what I'm saying? And they supported all kinds of stuff. And Italy also, you know, I've always had a lot of support in Italy, you know. And there's a lot of thinking that goes on around music over there. Or there was, especially during the 80s and 90s, that didn't go on here.
Right.
People just took things a lot more seriously.
Right.
And people that would write about Brecht would write about music or something, you know what I mean?
Right. How close did Ambitious Lovers come to
MTV? And fortune.
You know, because like 1984?
We started.
Right. And that was the year of Chaka Khan's I Feel For You and like all these super amazing complex pop records.
Ambitious Lovers was two. Yeah, we had a chance there. We had the usual music business stuff. We didn't have the strongest management. We weren't concerned that much with it ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we were just more interested in pursuing various different, you know, various things. We had to switch record labels, you know, and
yeah.
For one reason or another, we didn't, you know, go further than we did, you know.
Right.
But I still love those records.
Yeah.
You know, and I think they're really strong. Especially Greed, I think, is a really good record.
Do you miss New York?
I
mean, do you miss living here?
You know what I miss? I miss the weather. I miss the smell, the wind, the light, you know, because I lived here for so long. I mean, physically, I miss it sometimes. When I moved away from New York, I didn't think about it much at all, you know what I mean? And I still read the paper online every day. You know, in a way, I keep up.
Well, what about musically?
You know, musically,
and
I've started to come back here and to feel connected again. But, you know, there's a lot of musicians out there all over the place
that are
interesting to work with.
Tell me about your, you know, kind of everyday musical life in Rio in terms of working.
I do a bit of improvising down there. You know, there's a small but growing experimental music scene in Rio that's really great. I do the occasional show that's more to the pop side, you know, in different cities around Brazil. I'm planning to bring the band down there at the end of the year, you know what I mean? I thought about putting together a band of Brazilian musicians, but I decided to go with the New York guys.
Mm-hmm.
Even though we have a Brazilian member who lives in Paris, his name is Marival de Paim. He's one of the musical directors of Ilê Aiyê, you know. And he's a great, great musician. And I've known him since I produced
The Ilê Aiyê record,
you know. I don't do much producing anymore.
Well, that was going to be my next question, because there was a time in your life when you were sort of doing everything. I mean,
I did a lot of
really busy
in Brazil
and elsewhere,
but
Italy and
Japan, a lot in Japan. It's not very lucrative, and I'm not as interested. You know, it takes a lot of time. I'm just not so interested right now in doing that. You know, it's a full-time job to make somebody's record, you know. It takes 3 months. I kind of did it, you know. I mean, I did some records I'm proud of, and I don't know. It's just not – I don't find it so fascinating or whatever. Mm-hmm.
So the obvious question is, are you going to write new songs, you know? Is this band – I mean, where are you going to take this?
Well, we're definitely going to write new songs.
Yeah.
Want to make a record to come out next year. With these guys, I want to take the band to Brazil so they can soak it up, and I want to kind of develop our own sound, you know? We're just kind of starting to get there, you know? Melvin and I have a deep understanding. We've been together for a long, long time, and he's spent an awful lot of time in Brazil, participated in a lot of things I've done there, you know?
Sure.
And I want the other guys to have some of that experience. You know, so I think about making a record. I also think about developing the band, like a way of playing together and places to take the songs and all these things.
Did you tell me that you had stopped going to Carnival?
No. I haven't been to Carnival in Bahia for a couple of years.
Yeah.
But I hope to go this year.
Do you think that's part of the do you think that's part of the band process? Like
for them to live through Carnival?
Yeah,
for
yeah.
sure, for sure.
Really?
The big parade that I did there with Matthew,
which was 2004.
I put together a band for that, but we worked with 30 percussionists too. And we did something nobody ever did and nobody's done since, which is we got the guys on the truck to play with the guys on the street in time, you know, together. We were playing music together. No Brazilian, Carlinhos Brown, nobody ever managed to do that, and we did it.
What's so hard about it?
It's really hard, you know, to stay in sync and to, you know, it's like you have
just because of what you can hear as a musician?
Because of what you can hear, yeah, mm-hmm. you know. And for the music to be loud enough for the people on the street to enjoy, it's got to be distorted to a certain extent, which makes it hard to follow for the drummers.
So how did you pull it off?
Yeah, we put a lot of thought into it. We rehearsed all the songs, the band songs, with the drum machine. Then we had the drum leaders come in, and they played along, and we adjusted our tempos to where they were comfortable, you know, like playing a certain rhythm, you know?
Yeah.
Partly they're comfortable for reasons of habit, but also because of the just the, you know, physical reasons, how long it takes notes to decay and that kind of thing, you know what I mean? And the way the instruments work, there's certain tempos that work better for certain rhythms. And when it's a lot of people playing together, it's different than one person doing it when you have tons of people playing. We put speakers on the back of the truck that was carrying the band, and we blasted just the drum machine and the voice, because the drummers in Carnival are really used to following the voice, you know? I paid a lot of attention to giving them clear downbeats and stuff.
Right.
And then we also had a kind of a conductor who was standing up there on the back of the truck between the two things.
So they just had the drum machine, rhythmically, they just had the drum machine to deal with rather than a huge bunch of drum noises.
Yeah. And the voice, because believe me,
like
a click track. And the voice, because the way that these Bloco Afros work is you follow the voice, you know. Those singers, they're like, in a sense, they're like conductors, you know. Which is, you know, soul music has got some of that too. Live soul music has a lot of that element, I think.
Right. I just read something that you wrote in Wire magazine about, it was a series of like revelations about music, right?
Right.
And one of them was something about the fact that there's no, I'm probably paraphrasing it wrong, but you're interested in the idea that like music and motion are the same thing. Yeah? Or that motion
isn't that
is itself a kind of music.
Yeah, music is sound waves in motion, I guess. I don't remember the, you know, oddly enough, I thought, you know, I better reread this Wire thing before I go talk to Ben.
But you seem to be making some kind of argument that elements in life that are not necessarily seen as music can be sort of understood or read.
That's definitely
as musical.
Yeah, that's
sort
right.
of what you said.
That's sort of what I said. Yeah, for sure. You know, motion, proportion, you know, all these ways that we organize the way we understand music. You
right.
know, we can perceive them in other areas. You know what I mean?
Right. So that kind of makes sense. How the band having to go through the Carnival experience would be a kind of musically strengthening.
Yeah.
Exercise, because they'd be in the middle of all this
and they
kind
also
of
have,
like living yeah. music, you know, all this crazy
right.
motion.
Dancing. You know, once you see how people dance to a rhythm, you can kind of understand the dynamic of the rhythm.
Yeah.
You know, because a rhythm has a lot of levels, you know what I mean? It's like the pattern, it's the accent, you know, but it's also the rhythm as a melody. Is also there. You know what I'm saying? The way people hear it, the way people enjoy a rhythm. You know?
Yeah.
They enjoy it as melody. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And the reassuring nature of a pattern and the surprising nature built that can be built into a pattern, you know? It's the element of surprise that can be built into a pattern, that kind of thing.
Yeah. All right. Well, speaking of Carnival in Salvador, we'll go out with your song on Gina. And it's great to have you here, Arto.
Nice talking to you.
That's our show. Thanks for listening. You can hear Arto Lindsay's new record, Encyclopedia of Arto, out now on Northern Spy Records. And you can listen to our playlist from the dreaded Spotify, which has probably some of Arto Lindsay's music on it, if he's allowed that to happen.
I didn't have much to say about it.
Our producers are Jeremy Egner and Jocelyn Gonzalez, and we'll see you next week.